You could boil the headlines about the pandemic down to just COVID continues, but that would not tell you enough about the current state of affairs. A few major points at this moment. One, COVID has now killed more Americans than the Spanish flu epidemic of 1918 and 1919, though it is fair to point out that the country's population was about a third of what it is now back then. Point two, neighboring Idaho is now rationing care since the crush of people with COVID is overwhelming that state's hospitals. Point three, Jackson County's number of new COVID cases dropped under 1,000 last week for the first time in several weeks. In fact, dropped by 30% down to 734. Dr. Jim Shames is medical director at Jackson County Health and Human Services. He visits once a week to answer our many questions about viruses, vaccines, and more. So since Friday, this question has already changed a bit. You had two straight weeks just above 1,000 new cases, which was a plateau, but a high plateau, and now you're under that. Is there some sense of relief there, Jim?
Yeah. You know, everywhere you turn, you know, when the level of cases is high, the anxiety is high, the concern is high, and, you know, we do have a sense of relief. The hospitals are still having lots to do and are still very stressed, but I think there's a little bit of breathing room and they can begin to start looking at what more regular care might look like.
Yeah, speaking of hospitals, I was just checking those numbers. Region 5 is Jackson and Josephine counties together. We're still in the range of, out of 57 staffed adult ICU beds, there were 53 beds occupied and 4 beds available. Yeah. Outside of ICU, 415 beds occupied, 31 beds available. These are very low vacancy rates, which are normally, I assume, much higher than this.
Yeah. Well, they are quite a bit higher. As you probably know, Oregon has the fewest number of available hospital beds during good times. So we can quickly use up all of our reserve status, which we essentially did during the worst of this. And hospitalizations, ICUs, intubations, they lag behind the overall numbers. So when I say relief, some of it is just knowing what's coming in a week or two, but still the hospitals are quite full.
Speaking of what's coming then, I mean, we're now at the point where we're 2 weeks into pretty much everybody being back into school in person, and there have been some outbreaks as yet. What's the general situation out there?
You know, I think the schools are doing pretty well. Once you accept the fact that we just have to have in-person education, and we do all we can to mitigate. We always knew that there would be outbreaks, there would be kids getting sick, there'd be confusion, there'd be a lot of kids staying home because they're quarantined, and that's all happening. But in general, it feels to me like it's been successful. Some school districts more than others, and some of that is a reflection of the degree of vaccination for their particular communities.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that Talent Middle School, was it last week, was talking about having 100 kids quarantine?
Yeah. Yeah, the quarantine thing has been a real problem. It's the way to keep, you know, the outbreak from spreading quickly, but it does make sort of a very halting school experience.
True, but I imagine these schools are, and granted you don't work for the school districts, but that they still have their electronic school options available to be able to keep kids connected with classwork even when they're not there.
And hybrid education is still available to some extent,
mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
And I don't work for the school district either, so I don't know what each one of the districts are doing.
Okay. Yeah. Like I said. All right. So let's talk about vaccination. I noticed that in a release the previous week, September 9th, County Health really went back to basics in its news release, answering some basic fact and myth questions about vaccines. I mean, is it kind of going back to square one to try to reassure people? Hey, you remember vaccines, don't you?
So, are you talking about childhood vaccines and influenza vaccines, or
I'm talking about the COVID vaccines? Tanya's release, Tanya Phillips, from September 9th, about myth and facts about COVID-19 vaccines.
Right. Sure, we're trying to counter, you know, the information that's wrong that's on the internet every way we can, And we do hear the same arguments over and over again. So, yeah, Tanya, I think, does a really good job of trying to dispel those myths one at a time. Our other concern is that this vaccine hesitancy around COVID is going to affect people getting flu shots and children getting their childhood vaccine. So there's a degree of vaccine skepticism we've just never seen before, and I don't know how it's going to play out.
So is there any evidence at this point that you're seeing any resistance to flu shots? We're pretty early in the game with flu shots, aren't we?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're just getting influenza out now, so I don't know how that's going to be, and I don't know about childhood immunizations. The good news about childhood immunizations is it does look like we may get the Pfizer vaccine approved for children of school age, maybe even as soon as Halloween. So that's really good news.
That is so. So again, we're talking to Dr. Jim Shames here from Jackson County Health and Human Services, the medical director, answering our questions about COVID, talking about the many twists and turns this pandemic seems to take, still with us after a year and a half. You can join the conversation on the exchange with your questions and comments at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The number of people that Jackson County still has to vaccinate to get to 80%. Is still the largest single number for any county in Oregon at 31,322 as of the most recent update, which seems to budge a little each week. I think the last time I looked at it on Friday, it was 32,000 something. So there's that much ground been covered, but you still, I think, would prefer to have this moving a lot faster than it is.
Yeah. I mean, the numbers obviously keep moving up because even if you give one or two vaccines, you've moved the numbers up, but it's all going much slower than we certainly hoped or we expected, when the vaccines first came out. The reason that we have a large number to vaccinate, I think, is because even though we're in the middle in terms of the percentage of our population that's gotten vaccinated, of those counties that, have yet to get high vaccination rates, we're the largest. So, there's Josephine and Lake and Harney and Wallowa, but they're much smaller counties, and so although their percentages are greater, they have fewer people to get vaccinated to bring us up to an acceptable level. So, yeah, we have quite a bit of work to do here in Jackson County.
Yeah, your point is
vaccination rate.
Yeah, the point's right on target. Jackson County stands at 62.6%, which does put it right smack in the middle. It's an interesting color-coded chart at the Oregon Health Authority that I'm looking at, where it turns to a darker gray above 60%. So Jackson County is above that, but because of the size of the county's overall population, it just means that there are still 31,322 people needing to get vaccinated in order to get the county up to that 80% desired coverage level. So to some of the questions that Tanya Phillips put out there in that September 9th release, let's go through some of them. Is the mRNA vaccine considered a vaccine?
Oh, it's absolutely a vaccine. It's a very sophisticated, remarkable vaccine. It's clean. It's, when you have a side effect from the vaccine, that is to say you feel kind of sick and achy and flu-like, that's purely because the vaccine is stimulating your immune system for the, for this particular virus. There are other vaccines that have more antigens that can produce more discomfort after the vaccine that aren't really offering you protection. So it's a great vaccine. It's a technology that allows us to make other vaccines in the future quickly and inexpensively. So absolutely, it's a vaccine.
And as we've talked about in the past, the idea of mRNA vaccines has been well established for a while now, which is why they were able to move so quickly with the COVID vaccines, right?
Yeah, it's not really a new technology. It's a technology that was kind of waiting for the opportunity. I mean, if you think about it, we've got vaccines already for, lots of dread illnesses and so we have a new technology, but we already had existing vaccines. In this case, we had the need for a vaccine. The technology was available, And it was a technology that could ramp up pretty quickly. People, you know, talk about how long, you know, this was such a fast, hurried, rushed job of bringing vaccines on board. It really wasn't. We had the advantage of having a technology ready to go that was in and of itself, you know, fairly simple. I mean, it sounds, you know, science fiction, but in fact, you know, the actual making of the vaccine is pretty simple. And the government incentivized very rapid creation of factories, of manufacturing, of testing, so that it just moved quickly. Nobody cut any corners. These are great vaccines, and they've been very well tested and safe.
I want to go through some of the other vaccine myth-busting thing, but I want to bring in a phone call here now from Connie in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Jim Shames.
Good morning, gentlemen. I have a question that's been percolating for quite some time, and that is how long a person is communicable, I believe that's the right word, especially with the disease that's so unlike the standard flu where people are sick for such long periods of time, and also these long-term cases and people are testing positive multiply over time. I'm trying to figure out how safe it is or when it is safe to actually visit with friends or neighbors or interact with friends or neighbors or family, given all the wide parameters of the disease that COVID seems to encompass.
And you mean visiting? Like and you mean visiting with friends and family who have had it?
Have been sick and have been positive, and trying to figure out when it's really safe to visit them.
Okay, good question. Thanks for that, Connie. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Connie. That is a good question, and it's. Let me see if I can do it in an uncomplicated fashion. The disease of COVID itself, for the average person, that is one who's not severely immunocompromised, you get the virus, it multiplies in your nose and throat very quickly. And if you have a very sensitive testing device, you might be able to test some RNA in that person's nose before they even know they're sick. Then they get sick. When they are at the early stages of their illness, they're producing the maximum amount of virus, and they are quite communicable at that point. That's usually around day 3, 4, 5 from when they first had contact with the virus. So now they may be just getting sick. They're highly communicable. That communicability for most people doesn't last terribly long. The problem with COVID is it sets up an inflammatory response in the body that can go on for weeks or months. By the time people are in the hospital, in an ICU, intubated, in general, they're generally not contagious at that point. They're the sickest they've ever been, but the virus that's left in their nose and throat is probably mostly dead. The disease has moved on. It's moved deeper in the body. It's a different etiology for being ill than it was in the beginning. In the beginning, you get a flu-like syndrome because you've got a virus that's making you sick. In the end, you might have pulmonary failure because of an antigen-antibody response, you know, inflammatory responses, immune responses that were set up by the virus, but the virus is not what's making you sick. So, long story short, for most people who are not immunocompromised, the actual period of infectivity is probably relatively short, days. But the PCR tests detect actual RNA, whether it's living or dead, whether it's fragments or whole. And so for some people, the PCR test may be positive for weeks and weeks after the onset of illness. And it's confusing. You know, we have to sort of go on that, so to speak. But for most people, they're unlikely to still be contagious weeks after the onset of illness. Did that begin to cover the question?
Yeah, I would think so. And Connie, thanks for that. But basically, days 3, 4, 5 after exposure are the most significant for that. And after that, it drops off quite a bit.
It does. Now, the PCR test, being so sensitive, will continue to pick up viral fragments for a long time. The antigen test, the quick test, the 15-minute response test, are less sensitive, but they are certainly sensitive enough that if you are sick and the sickness is due to COVID, those rapid tests are pretty darn accurate. if you're trying to figure out, you know, should I fly on an airplane because I want to know if I'm incubating COVID, they may not be sensitive enough for that.
Dr. Jim Shames, our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange, joining us weekly to answer our questions about COVID-19 and vaccines and viruses and treatments and variants. And you can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Daniel in Eugene sent an email. He's challenging the idea that these are vaccines. He says, please clarify, Pfizer, Moderna, et cetera, are not vaccines. In quotes, they are treatments. They do not kill the virus. They do not kill the cells that house the virus. They let the virus continue to live and mutate. Would anyone accept having a mild case of polio? Please call these COVID drugs something other than vaccines, as they are not vaccines. Thanks, Daniel in Eugene. I think you would disagree with that, Jim Shames.
Well, I mean, just because Daniel says it does not make it true. I mean, they are classic vaccines. They produce an immune response that you then carry with you for years, maybe the rest of your life, that gets activated, reactivated, if you should be exposed to the virus again. That's what vaccines do. Treatments, you know, go out and kill the virus. We have antivirals that will kill the virus, but they don't protect you in any way from getting it again. So, no, they're vaccines.
Is part of the misunderstanding there from the idea that you can still get COVID, but just a milder case with these vaccines? I mean, I think when people get flu shots, do they expect not to get the flu or just to get a milder case of it?
Well, yeah, you got it. They get a milder case of it. Mm-hmm. Often. That's what vaccines do. They're not designed to prevent you from getting from the virus getting into you and replicating. The goal of the vaccine primarily is to keep you from getting seriously ill. And we know that this vaccine does that very well. Whether or not it produces sterilizing immunity such that you can't replicate the virus in your body and pass it to another, that's always icing on the cake to the extent you get that from the vaccine. Mm-hmm. But that was not what was being tested for when the vaccine was produced.
You know, I hadn't even thought about that issue with flu shots, though, because I've been getting them regularly for years now, and I think I got what felt like a case of the flu about 5 years ago that just knocked me on my tush, but that lasted about 36 hours, and then I felt better.
Yeah. Yeah, that's, as I said, that's what we're hoping vaccines will do for us, is to reduce the severity of the illness and, you know, to the extent that it prevents the disease from spreading, we're certainly looking for that as well. But to some extent, most vaccines you can get a mild form of the disease, and occasionally you can even get a severe form of the disease, but it greatly reduces the likelihood of that.
All right. Jamie in Medford dropped off a question and says he's fully vaxxed, wants to know if he should get his booster shot for COVID when he gets his flu shot this fall.
There's a lot of confusion about the booster shots, and there's many reasons for that. The CDC has yet to weigh in with the FDA officially about booster shots. Our expectation is that they will be approved for those over the age of 65 and those with underlying health conditions, probably Pfizer first, followed by Moderna and J&J. But at the moment, third shots are approved for those who are immunocompromised, and booster shots are officially still being contemplated.
Okay.
Now, it is very unlikely that an adult getting a booster shot is going to be harmed in any way. It is quite likely they'll be benefited. We do find ourselves wasting vaccines sometimes when we open a vial. So I think a number of people are getting booster shots, but it's kind of off-label at the moment, and it has not yet been approved.
All right, and I see that there are various federal committees and some Western states committees meeting through this week to decide what should go on with the booster shots with Pfizer, which again is the only one that has the full authorization of the FDA for adults at this moment. Is the full authorization for children just about there, happening soon? What do we know about that?
I don't know that I know what anybody else who's sort of paying attention knows. It sounds like, well, I do know that the vaccine seems to be quite safe for children, doesn't have a lot of side effects, is very protective. How quickly it'll move through the FDA approval process, I don't know. Again, the latest I'm hearing is possibly in a month or a month and a half, and I think things should move very quickly at that point. That is, once it's approved, I think school-age kids will be able to get the vaccine quite quickly. A lot of people are waiting for that and preparing for that.
Let's back up to Jamie's more general question about flu shots, which is there a particular sweet spot? I mean, you can get the thing anywhere from October to March, I think. And is there a particular best time, you think, to get that?
You know, they used to say that. They used to say that November was kind of the sweet spot because rarely was there a flu outbreak prior to that. We've had years, however, when flu comes, it comes quickly. So it might be, I think I'll wait till November, and meanwhile, there's a big upsurge in flu in October, and you kind of missed your moment. I think the CDC is right that when the flu shot is available to you, go get it. And it lasts longer than we thought in the beginning. That is, it will probably last you through the flu season. The flu season is unpredictable, and I don't think any of us want the risk of getting flu and COVID at the same time. Get your flu shot, and I would get it as soon as it's available, which is pretty much now. You can make a reservation now, an appointment to get your flu shot at public health, for example.
Okay. Dr. Jim Shames, Jackson County Medical Director at Health and Human Services. Thanks for joining us once again to answer our questions about COVID and other diseases.
You bet.